Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Student loan debt, crushing debt at that, has just become the new normal. Many experts say it's a legitimate crisis that's gotten out of control, with nearly 45 million Americans now bearing the burden of $1.7 trillion of debt. And continuous hikes in tuition and fees are leading many to question if higher education is worth the price tag. Ahead on Insight, we're going to take a look at a new report addressing what college is actually worth. We'll also learn more from a first-time homebuyer and CAP Radio news editor, Chris Hooks, his experience of buying a house in Sacramento's red-hot real estate market, and the reminders of how redlining excluded his family from owning the house he now calls home. And we take a trip to the beloved and historic Mule Day celebration, which resumed Memorial Day weekend in the Eastern Sierra. But first, the country's political landscape continues to evolve under the Biden administration, with new major pieces of legislation, constant party clashes, and much more now shaping 2021. Ken Rudin is a longtime political journalist and host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. He joins us now to help make sense of it all. Welcome back, Ken.
Good morning, Vicky, and lots of luck with me trying to make sense of anything.
Right. But we're going to do our best, okay? You know, let's talk about the president's $6 trillion budget proposal. I mean, he laid out his spending plan back in April, but we're now getting a clearer picture, kind of a more detailed, itemized look at the president's priorities. What are your key takeaways?
I think the biggest takeaway is that not only is President Biden suggesting and proposing some of the biggest spending in the government since the New Deal, the FDR New Deal, he doesn't have the large majorities in Congress that FDR did or even Lyndon Johnson did. I mean, when Johnson and Roosevelt offered their bills, I mean, Democrats had overwhelming majorities in the House and Senate. Right now, the Democrats have a net gain, a net lead of 4 or 5 seats in the House. There's a special election today in New Mexico that Democrats are expected to win, and then it'll move up to 5 seats. And it's 50-50 in the Senate. So for all the things that Joe Biden wants to happen, for all the things that the Democratic majority, the slim majority, want to happen, it's going to be pretty remarkable because not all the Democrats are on board. Clearly, all the Republicans are opposed, led by Mitch McConnell. And so I think the contrast between what Biden is trying to accomplish and the actual numbers is just a fascinating dichotomy here.
Well, the president's proposal would project debt rising past World War II levels, which would be a record. Can you explain the meaning behind this debt and these deficits and how much they matter, or even if they do matter anymore in general in 2021?
Well, if you're a Republican, it matters if there's a Democratic president. If the Democratic president is offering tremendous increases in the debt and the deficit, then it's a terrible thing. When George W. Bush broke the bank, basically, I mean, in the aftermath of 9/11, all the spending that Bush pushed through, led by defense, all the spending that Donald Trump led, including the building of the wall and things that Trump thought were very important, Republicans didn't care about it. In the old days, Republicans talked about fiscal sanity, and yet that goes out the window when it's a Republican president. When it's a Democratic president, it seems like it's a big thing. But I don't know. Honestly, I don't know if voters care about it. They didn't. I mean, for all of Bush and Obama and Clinton and Trump's troubles, I don't think piling on debt as serious as it is, because we always tell everybody that it's going to affect our children and grandchildren and further generations. Yet ultimately, when people go to the ballot box, I don't think the federal deficit seems to be a leading issue, not even the top five.
Hmm. President Biden, he also touted progress of the state of the pandemic ahead of the Memorial Day weekend. You know, but the country's response to COVID-19 is continuing to evolve. What is the latest into the investigation that the Biden administration launched last week into the origin of the virus?
Well, that's interesting. You know, something, I mean, one of Donald Trump's arguments from the beginning is that it was not, the virus did not happen from animal to human. I think the original thought was maybe it was a bat or bats in China, but it may have come from a lab in Wuhan. And that's what Donald Trump said, and mostly everybody, especially the Democrats and much of the media, poo-pooed it, said, no, that's not true. Dr. Fauci said, that's not true. And now Dr. Fauci is saying that there may be something to it. I don't know what if it's proven that it did come from a lab in China, I don't know if that'll do anything other than ramp up anti-Chinese feelings in this country. Now, we're seeing a huge amount of anti-Asian prejudice and violence in the country. And I don't know if that's because of the pandemic. It may be because, you know, when Donald Trump would talk about the Hong Kong flu, and he'd have so much fun mocking the Chinese and mocking Asians, basically. I remember there was an Asian reporter from CBS News who asked a question at a press conference, and Donald Trump basically mocked her and said, well, you basically one of those, well, you people should take care of this, you know, meaning because she's Asian. Asian American. So there is an increase in prejudice. I don't know what it would mean. If anything, maybe Donald Trump could say, I told you so. But at the same time, Donald Trump belittled and just basically mocked the severity of the virus during the final year of his presidency, calling it no worse than the flu, saying it was a plot by the Democrats and the media to defeat him. So I don't know if Donald Trump should get any credit about anything doing regarding the flu, but he certainly did raise the issue about the fact that it could have come out of a lab in Wuhan, and that seems to be possibly the case.
You know, another big story just internationally is Israel and Palestine. The conflict is continuing to make its presence felt here in the United States. How is that impacting the Biden administration?
Well, that's a very good question. And a lot of people are talking about this because once upon a time, the Democrats were the party of unhesitatingly supportive of the state of Israel. Republicans just were not so much involved. Now because the politics have changed, the Democratic Party is really split on what Israel has been doing, not only about the 11-day assault on Gaza. I mean, yes, they did respond to rockets, but at the same time, what they inflicted on the people of Gaza, it was like 100 times worse than what happened when Gaza sent the rockets into Israel. So the Democratic Party is split between its progressive wing, led by perhaps people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and some of the squad in the House, and maybe Bernie Sanders in the Senate, who says that, you know, a blank check to Netanyahu in Israel is not the answer, given the fact that the terrible suffering that the people in Palestine is going through. So if nothing else, I mean, look, there's so much more than that because people are suffering, but the political fallout of what's going on in Israel has split the Democratic Party and the Republicans could not be more happy than what they're seeing.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about where the Republican Party is right now. You know, former President Donald Trump, what has he been up to these days? I mean, obviously his influence is still very much felt among Republicans and the party's future.
Well, you don't see him on Twitter, and I say thank goodness for that. You don't see him on Facebook, but what you do see is that Republicans, for the most part, still believe that the 2020 election was stolen. And the fact is that Donald Trump has made it clear that he will go after Republicans he feels were not as loyal or not loyal at all to his cause, including those 10 House Republicans who voted for impeachment and the 7 Senate Republicans who voted to convict him during the Senate trial. So Donald Trump has made it very clear that he will pick winners and losers in 2022. I think it's remarkable, or maybe even beyond remarkable, that Republicans felt that Liz Cheney, who was once the number 3 Republican in the House, the chairperson of the House Republican Conference, was more of a threat, more of a distraction, more of an enemy than people like Marjorie Taylor Greene, who trots out these anti-Semitic mocking the Holocaust, you know, saying that, you know, people should wear, you know, when stores give out yellow stars to show that they were vaccinated, it's just like what the Nazis did with the Jews when they made them wear yellow stars. That is so beyond the pale, and yet that doesn't seem to upset Republicans as much as the Adam Kinzingers and the Liz Cheneys and the Mitt Romneys who dare to question Trump's lie about what happened in 2020 or what happened on January 6th.
Well, you know, obviously what we've been talking about, so much going on and evolving. Finally, what are you on the lookout for going forward?
Well, I'm fascinated what's going on in Texas. I mean, I think it's very remarkable that it happened on that 100th anniversary of the Tulsa massacre, which so few Americans know about. But the fact that the Republicans are willing in many states, we've seen it already pass in Georgia, Florida, and Iowa, and it's going on in other states. Texas may have the most restrictive voting processes in the country by taking away absentee votes, curtailing the amount of hours they can vote. You know, the souls to the polls when blacks in Harris County, Texas, can go straight from church to the voting booth. That's going to be taken away from this law in Texas. They are not only trying to suck up to Donald Trump's argument that there's so much cheating at the polls, but they also know that demographics in Texas are changing fast. And perhaps the only way that the Republicans can keep their rule of politics is to suppress the vote. And that, sadly, is happening in many states around the country. And that's why the legislation that's going on in the House and in the Senate that is being blocked by Mitch McConnell and company because of a threat of a filibuster is so important to the future of voting rights in this country.
Ken Rudin is a longtime political journalist and host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. Thanks for joining us today.
Vicky, did you notice that my last sentence was 25 seconds? No, it was 45 seconds long. That was just one sentence. Lots to talk about. Thanks, Vicky.
You're good at run-ons, Ken. Nice having you again. Till next time. Up next, we're going to be joined by first-time homeowner and Cap Radio news editor Chris Hooks with more on his experience and saga of buying a house in Sacramento's red-hot real estate market. We'll also get a closer look at a new report addressing what college is actually worth. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Well, Sacramento is a red-hot real estate market, the 13th hottest in the country, to be exact, and that's according to the most recent data from Realtor.com. Well, that's good news for sellers who are getting more per square foot and selling sooner than ever, but the greater Sacramento population is also growing every day, and demand has been pent up, especially among millennial first-time home buyers who are facing high prices, fierce competition. Cap Radio news editor Chris Hooks, he knows this all too well. He is one of those first-time millennial home buyers. He and his wife recently bought a house in South City Farms, and Chris joins us now about his experience. Welcome back to Insight, Chris, and congratulations.
Thank you, Vicky.
You know, just following you on Twitter, can you just kind of explain the saga and the frustration that you felt trying to buy a home? I mean, you know, first-time homeowner, it's a new experience. I would imagine curveballs are expected, but did you expect it to be so difficult?
No, flat out no. I mean, we started early February looking. We saw over 40 something houses, close to 50, put offers in on maybe a dozen. I did not expect any of that, honestly. Truthfully, I didn't.
You know, and even
especially not going into it.
Yeah. I mean, you just said that you put offers on about a dozen homes. You know, there's an emotional experience with that. There's a lot of hope that goes into that. And then the missing out and that falling short. Did you and your wife feel demoralized during this process or even question whether now was the right time to buy a home?
I mean, absolutely. There were times where, I mean, our backup plan was obviously to just step aside, save more, and go back at it in a year. Truthfully, our backup plan was to use some of the money and get tattoos, but
mark the moment of frustration in your life.
Right. There was a lot going into it, obviously. We had enough money saved, and we thought that we had everything that we needed. Obviously, that wasn't the case because of what this market is. And maybe after the 25th house, I stopped counting. Really, after like the 18th house, I stopped counting. But it really did get exhausting. I mean, my brother and his fiance right now are also looking for a house, so we're doing it simultaneously. They've stopped completely, and it did get a little demoralizing, especially after having to write a lot of letters and like personalized letters to say, look, this is why we want homes. It's specifically in certain areas. And hearing no, definitely it sucks. Truly.
What did your real estate agent, how did they explain what was happening? Because were they confirming the fact that this is, you know, this isn't usual. It's an unusual buying market right now, given, you know, a variety of circumstances.
Yeah. I mean, our real estate agent was really great at explaining things. I think it helps that I also follow some people on like social media who explain a lot of trends, and things like that. But our realtor, she absolutely broke things down really, really well in ways that we didn't expect to understand going in. We actually switched realtors about halfway through the process, looking for someone who was a bit more experienced in getting people in contract in this current hot market. It was the smart move to do because she knew exactly what to do and she knew how to navigate the market that we're currently in. Mm-hmm. So
when it comes down to the budget, and obviously you're familiar with the area, you probably had neighborhoods that you wanted more than others that you were prioritizing. Did you end up in the neighborhood that you wanted?
Not that we wanted. I mean, my family is from Oak Park, and ideally that was where we wanted to stay. That's where we wanted to buy. And in the future, that's still where I would want to buy and live probably the rest of my days, just because, I mean, that's family, that's history. My family has owned a home there since the 1950s when Black folks couldn't buy homes in most of Sacramento. So it's just, I mean, the history is there and that's where we wanted to stay. Obviously that wasn't the case in the end. A lot of the home prices there are a little more than what we could afford. But also, I mean, there were times where the listing price of homes in Oak Park were right in our budget, but we went in at the max of what we could go in at, and people were offering $35,000 over max. Wow. Over our max, I should say.
Well, when talking about the issue of redlining, which the impact is still very much felt in cities like Sacramento, you know, you tweeted a photo of, you know, the charter of your home, and that, you know, I guess if can you explain that and the significance of that?
Yeah. I mean, in a lot of documents in homes throughout Sacramento, throughout the country, really, because of redlining, there was a lot of wording and documents for homes that said non-white people can't buy or rent those homes. I believe ours specifically said something along the lines of, unless you're a servant, you can't live in that house, or build homes or on the land in general. And obviously, I think stuff like that just sort of reinforced why we wanted to buy homes in those sorts of areas, because, I mean, we were excluded from there before. And our families, knowing the history of what our families could and couldn't do, that's what we wanted to do. Plus, I think it helps that neither of us were raised in areas that were predominantly white. And I mean, South City Farms is an area that is very, very much diverse. I mean, I haven't gone into a plan on it at some point, but looking into the history of South City Farms, but I know demographics wise, it's pretty diverse, about 15% Black, about 30% Latinx, 12% Asian. Like, it's very diverse in that neighborhood. And that's something that we looked for going into buying a house. Mm-hmm. So,
I mean, when talking about a home, I mean, that's the greatest source of wealth and generational wealth. And you're talking about, you know, people of color being prohibited from that, essentially. And I would imagine being a first-time homeowner for your family that lives in Home Park, also for you and your wife, the idea of home and owning a home has a deeper significance and a deeper meaning to it.
Yeah. I mean, for me personally, me and my mom moved around 22, 23 times before I turned 18 or before I graduated high school. Buying a house was never really an idea to me. Not until I got much older and sort of understood the reasoning and the impact and why Black folks need to own homes and land in general. But, yesterday was the centennial of Tulsa Massacre, like things like that, redlining, the former GI, I mean, so many things that like went against allowing Black folks to build that generational wealth. And I mean, you look at the racial wealth gap right now, and even just the wealth gap in general, it's so stark when you compare to Black folks and white folks, because of all of these things that happened in the past that stopped Black folks from wanting to and being able to buy homes and create that wealth over time. So a lot of that stuff did factor into us buying a house.
Hmm. Well, I'm happy you stuck through it, because that sounds like just such a frustrating experience. But now you and your wife have a place to call home, one that you own. And congratulations on that.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Well, Chris Hooks is Cap Radio's news editor, first-time home buyer. Thanks for joining us and sharing your experience.
Thank you, Vicki.
Well, you're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. All right, I'm going to go out on a limb and say this may be a familiar thought amongst yourself or someone you know, remembering the nostalgia of college, but then looking at how it fits into your current career and salary, not to mention the years or decades of student debt. Perhaps asking yourself, what is college actually worth? A new report spearheaded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is unpacking college affordability and debt through the lens of race, socioeconomics, gender, and social justice. Finding the value of who it benefits, how, and how much varies greatly. Dr. Sue Desmond-Hellman is co-chair of the Post-Secondary Value Commission, also former CEO and current advisor of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And Michelle Siqueiros is commissioner of the Post-Secondary Value Commission and president of Campaign for College Opportunity. I started off by asking Dr. Desmond-Hellman, the Post-Secondary Value Commission formed in 2019, what prompted the research that is nearly the culmination of 2 years of research?
The research was prompted by a growing understanding of a couple of things that were going on in higher ed. First of all, the inequities that we knew were apparent in outcomes, particularly for students of color, continued, and if anything, were more distressing. But secondly, we started to hear families, and people called it dinner table conversations, where families were asking, is college really right for you? And students saying, is college right for me? And so that gave us great concern, because we've always believed and still believe that college can be such a wonderful door opener for students and their families to both economic and non-economic gains.
The report that was just released earlier this month, is that the culmination of essentially 2 years of work and research?
It is. It's an effort that was done together by the Gates Foundation with the Institute for Higher Education Policy. My co-chair in this work has been Dr. Mildred Garcia, and 30 commissioners, a very diverse group of folks who pushed hard on us co-chairs and each other to add value and to really move the field. The field has been very much about completion. So this was a not a shift, because we still think completion is very important, but an add to think, don't just complete, but get value from what you've done with your higher education.
College affordability and debt has long been an issue and a topic of conversation for a lot of people. What is new or different about this research?
Well, there's several things new and different about the research. One is that the commission took a step back and said, yeah, we're all talking about college affordability. That, as you said, this is not news, but let's push ourselves to define what we mean by value. Let's push ourselves to measure outcomes. And so we had a lot of focus on measurement, including some data at University of Texas, which was institutional measurements on outcomes, which is really critical for people to get that. And finally, and I think most importantly, talking about action, what action universities can take, what action policymakers need to take, and what action students and families can take to address this issue. So a much more, I would say, numeric and action-oriented approach to the challenges.
You know, you mentioned the word value, and the commission, they established a definition for value, and that goes alongside through the lens of race and ethnicity, income, gender, the type of institution, and the type of program that they are invested in. What did you learn in the 2 years that you've been researching this?
Well, let me give you one fact that it just sort of slapped me in the face. If you look today in America, Latinx adults with a bachelor's degree or higher earn 25% less than their white peers, while Black adults earn 21% less. So same thing, go into get that higher ed, get them have an economic gain. So that kind of inequity is just incredibly challenging. I mentioned the University of Texas has more granular data. They also found, in addition to these disparities in students of color, they found that Caucasian students who don't finish school nearly achieve the same economic gains as their counterparts who are Latinx or Black who did get a degree. And so the everywhere we turned when we would get data, the inequities literally stare us in the face.
You know, the whole reason why we go to college is that it'll pay dividends for us and for the generations that follow us. I would imagine when you discovered those findings, that has long-term consequences when you're talking about equity.
It absolutely does. If you look overall, a white college graduate has 8 times the wealth of a household headed by a Black college graduate. So that overall wealth is just, the differences matter. And let me just mention, because we haven't talked about it, we did this, we carried out the work of the commission largely during the COVID-19 pandemic and at a time of incredible racial reckoning in the United States. And so the work of the commission absolutely was touched by the community around us and the circumstances around us. And so I think that these findings of inequity are particularly poignant when you recognize that the COVID-19 impact has become disproportionately impactful on Black, Latinx, Indigenous, Asian American, and Pacific Islanders, and women have had disproportionate impact of the pandemic. And so the commission wasn't looking at value of higher ed in isolation. It's always given the circumstances you live in.
Well, Michelle, that brings me to you. I mean, this report is looking at college affordability through the lens of social justice. We've been talking about equity, especially compounded with the pandemic. What were the main issues that surprised you the most or that you found to be the most revealing?
I mean, I think what I appreciated, I don't know if it was a big surprise, but what I appreciated is that we went deep with the commissioners on really defining value. You know, I'm the first in my family to go to college. I don't need to tell anybody about the value of college. I live it. you know, as a first gen college grad, I see the amount of opportunities and access to a profession that I love and get paid well to do every single day, right? So value in that very narrow sense, it isn't that narrow for an immigrant kid, you know, that was able to benefit from college. But I think going deep and what Sue talked about is really that the value isn't equitable across the board, right? That some folks, depending on the color of their skin or their gender, experience the value of a college education much differently, even if they've earned that degree in the STEM fields. For example, some of the granular data that Sue cited also looks at, you know, STEM graduates, which you would think, right, wouldn't have that kind of inequity. So I think it's continues to really highlight the level of inequality that we continue to tolerate in America. And I think the commission's effort to define value and to push policymakers to think about what must be done to address those inequities is what's most exciting to me, right? I live in this action space and a policy advocacy space, and in pushing our institutions to do better and to help address that inequality.
College students, we touched upon this briefly, but I think it deserves more exploring. You know, college students are also casualties of the pandemic, including recent graduates. It's not just distance learning. It was also the lack of job opportunity. I mean, how does this further exacerbate the challenges of college actually being worth the expense?
Well, your comment about jobs, I think, is so important. And what Michelle said about the I think in some ways we shone a light on the situation. One of the things I like about the report is that it enables, and we'll be putting out another data report in late summer, it enables students to ask the right questions. What's it going to cost for me to get this degree? How long does it take for the average student to get this degree? What are the job opportunities with this degree? And so there has been changes in employment with the pandemic. I keep hearing it's going to be like the Roaring Twenties. So maybe there'll be job creation like the Roaring Twenties. But I know the power of data and from selecting your institution, paying for it, and getting a job afterwards. Our hope is that that data is a tool that enables those students to look, and it may be that students are going to need a career change or a career option that's different than the one they had before. Those are challenging circumstances. But if that is the case, they'll have data to drive them in the direction they go.
Did the research also look at community college and an associate's degree, trade schools, extension programs, and look at the value of those opportunities and alternatives?
So yes, I mean, when we talk about, you know, the value of a college education, we are talking about the value of going to community college or going to a four-year granting institution. And the reality is that there's very real value in getting any kind of training beyond high school. I mean, that's the kind of society we live in today, right? Where, I mean, just look at who was most impacted by COVID-19 pandemic and by the recession that, you know, kind of was ensued by the pandemic, the loss of jobs that happened during the pandemic. It is, you know, white collar workers that have the privilege of being able to work from home and who have the kind of job security because they have a college credential or degree. So we absolutely talk about value in that broader sense of everything post high school.
What does this report not cover that still needs to be looked at?
I I don't know, Sue, what you think, but you know, my sense is obviously that the bigger challenge is the workplace, you know, discrimination that's likely, very much based on race and ethnicity that's happening in our society, right? How do you explain the inequity in salaries for folks that have a similar degree? When the correlation you see is race and ethnicity, right? So I think that is a broader challenge of, you know, our society and the business community, in terms of what inequities still persist, what discrimination still exists, even amongst those who have a college education.
Yeah, for sure, workplace. And it starts with inequities in the workplace. That is the most important. I would add to that that the other thing that's really challenging, and we had a discussion of this early on at the commission, it would be great if you knew what the degrees are that are that sort of portal of entry for those students in today's economy. And yet that changes so quickly, especially for a two-year degree, but four-year degree, everything that the job market can change so fast that you feel like you're chasing your tail. So what I think we ended up at is students really need to be enabled wherever their career leads them, but it's not unreasonable for them to count on continued training and thriving in the workplace. But that does take an equitable workplace where everybody thrives. And I would just add one other thing to the comments that Michelle made, that both in the workplace and I would say in the college or university itself, increasing the knowledge and the skills base of leaders and participants, faculty, in the kinds of things they can do to decrease inequity and to enable students to thrive. I think there's a lot of people of goodwill who look at these data and they're really unhappy that students aren't having a more equitable outcome. And that gets to the action part of this is, so therefore, if you're unhappy about the outcomes, how do you change to change the outcomes?
Well, on that note, my final question is, so we now know more about the layers of college and what it's worth and to whom. What does the future of college debt and opportunity look like in the coming years, let's say the next 5 years, as a result of research like this?
Well, I feel pretty optimistic given the huge national investment proposed and included in funding by the federal government to higher education, and certainly in our own state in California, pretty deep investments to expand access and to address equity. You know, our own California governor focused on a recovery with equity in mind. And so I think that we see a broader commitment nationally around closing the gaps, because I think we see how interconnected we all are, right? If we do not expand opportunity to a quality education, that is going to hurt our nation's economy. It isn't going to produce the workforce we need for the kind of 21st century skills that are necessary. So I feel pretty hopeful by the investments, by the real analysis around debt forgiveness, for example, that the national, you know, our federal government is having conversations about that I think are very much equity based and centered. So those are things that certainly give me hope in terms of the public funding of higher education. And I think the Post-Secondary Value Commission really allows students and families to also understand, you know, that value and how best to get that value through their own participation in higher ed.
I'm really also very optimistic about access and affordability. And I'm also very positive about the ability of workplaces to partner with higher ed and to look at anything they can do to accelerate the equity mission that, that the commission is so committed to. And it's in their best interest, which is great. It's good for business to have a steady stream of highly talented, well-trained, not debt-ridden, but ready to go graduates. And so I think increasingly government policy combined with business needs are a really great mix.
Dr. Sue Desmond-Hellman is co-chair of the Post-Secondary Value Commission, and Michelle Siqueiros is a commissioner of the Post-Secondary Value Commission. They were just discussing a new report spearheaded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, unpacking college affordability and debt through the lens of race, socioeconomics, and gender. Our conversation was recorded on Wednesday. Their report on the value of college is on our Insight page at capradio.org. Still ahead, we take a trip to the Eastern Sierra along Highway 395 to the town of Bishop. The rural Inyo County community resumed a beloved historic festival with pandemic restrictions behind them, Mule Days. You can join the conversation too. Email us at insight@capradio.org or use the Twitter hashtag AskInsight. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Inside on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Well, every Memorial Day since 1969, the Eastern Sierra town of Bishop pays homage to the mule. Part female horse, part male donkey, mules were essential packers across the Eastern Sierra. Bishop is north of Death Valley and Mount Whitney, south of Mammoth along Highway 395. Tens of thousands of people, not to mention hundreds of mules, travel along Highway 395 for a week-long festival that's part mule show and part Wild West show. But like most things last year, Mule Days was canceled for the first time since 1969, dealing an economic blow to rural Eastern Sierra towns. I took the trip to Mule Days on Friday. I caught up with Denton Sonkey and his son, Dave Sonkey. Denton was this year's Grand Marshal. The Sonkey family has been part of Mule Days pretty much since its inception more than 50 years ago.
God made Montana for the wild man, for the pagan.
Well, my name is Denton Sonkey, and I'm basically a California boy. I was born in Merced, California, moved to Bishop in 1970, and in 1972 became involved with Mule Days.
The Lord called Charlie to his home up yonder. He said, Kim Russell.
And I tell you, it's been a great trip.
Up in old Montana. How does it feel being here after last year it was canceled?
When you don't have, you know, several thousand people coming to town. Just like when we have the parade, which unfortunately we don't have this year, but Main Street will be lined with people watching that parade. I mean, all the way from the start to the finish. And that tells you right there what a benefit it is for this community as well as the communities around us. You know, Mammoth Lakes, the Lone Pine, Big Pine, they're all benefit from that. Well, it's kind of nervous type, you know, you don't like to see those things happen. But that's the way life is. You know, they have the ups and downs. And the thing that you have to do when you have a setback like we had last year, you have to move ahead on a positive basis, which is what we've done. And I just feel so proud of.
Evening, everybody. Y'all ready? You know, I think we've done that enough time for enough years that you expect it and you know when it's coming. Due to the fact that we are all alive together in this beautiful evening in Bishop, California, in Inyo County, what do you say we do it one more time? Are you ready? You know, with social distancing and a few pockets here and there, it still sounds like 10,000 strong. God bless you all for being here.
An Okanagan riding a wind dark and windy day.
My name is Dave Sonke, and I've been a resident of Bishop for most of my life. Moved here when I was 10 years old.
We've all had a year of unpredictability, right? And Mule Days obviously was canceled last year. Being here this year, how are you feeling?
Well, since this is actually the first year in almost 50 years that I've been here as a spectator, it's great. Seeing the people, you know, people I've known for years and years and years, and new people, and just seeing everybody out enjoying themselves and getting reacquainted with the mule. You know, it's an incredible animal, and that's part of what this event is about, is exhibiting the capabilities of the mule.
I came here in 2019, and we were hard-pressed to yes. get a hotel if you just wanted to drive through and stay in Bishop. Yeah. The past year, I mean, given that you're a local here, I mean, these are your neighbors, and you just mentioned your tourism industry, and that basically was just like knocked on its butt, right?
Yes.
I guess talk to us about that. There's a lot of challenges with that.
Yeah, you know, it is a small town, and you know, they care for each other, and obviously this last year has been very difficult for a lot of different reasons to everybody, and you know, we don't live in town anymore. But we still have a lot of friends here, so we're talking to them, and we do see them, and just seeing the emotional impact it had on people. And the economic impact has just been devastating on this community, as well as others. You know, when restaurants can't be open, and, you know, it's just on and on and on. It's been a very challenging year for the local community. And that's, to me, you know, what makes this year's event such a special event is it's like there's a reawakening, and everybody's just so excited to be out and about and enjoying life again and seeing people and just being with one another. And I didn't get a chance to get downtown this morning or today, but I understand it's just an absolute madhouse down there, which is great. Cars, people everywhere, and you know, Memorial Day is a very big year or a weekend for this community and the surrounding area. So it's great to see that reawakening.
Yeah, I was actually there today. I went to a couple stores and bought some items, and it was definitely bustling in a very good way. A lot of smiles. Even when we were walking here before we did this interview, just like, you know, everyone, like the people are shouting out when they're at the concession stand in your pink shirt. And I mean, there's a lot of meaning behind those interactions.
There is, you know, the group you're talking about, my wife was a teacher here, and she was a very well-liked teacher when she was working here, and a lot of those were the moms of the girls that she would teach in junior high. But you do run into that all the time, whether it's through your kids' connections or your work connections, or, you know, here at Mule Days. And you know, here at Mule Days, I'm always running into people I haven't seen since last time I was at Mule Days. But it is a homecoming every time we get here.
You've been talking to your dad, Denton. He got emotional talking, sitting up at the front after the decades he's been a part of this, and you're nodding. So you're not surprised by that.
Yeah, I was trying to hold back the emotion a little bit ago. Yeah, it is a very special event. I mean, it's hard to explain. It's a very personal experience coming here.
Yippee-yi-yo, ghost riders in the sky.
You know, I've always said that Mule Days is a great reunion, not only of the participants that come up here, but for the workers here in the community and outside of the community, that we all work together and, you know, we don't always see each other through the time, you know, through the time. But this is an opportunity for us to come together. Oh, there's Vicky. You know, I mean, so good to see you. And that's how it goes. It really is very special.
Thank you very much, everybody.
And that was Denton Zonke and his son, Dave Zonke, with music from John and Betsy Elliott during the Mule Day show on Friday. That's Insight for today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.